Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And, folks, it's all about constitutional compliance. It is all about our right to demand compliance to the rule of law. As a matter of fact, I had to whip out the Declaration of Independence a little early so that I could point out to you that this is a right that we have to hold our government accountable. They didn't put the right of petition and assembly in the Bill of Rights and protect it just because it seemed like, you know, this whimsical thing. Who knows? People may want to do something. I'm at a loss as to how far and why it's gotten this far down the road. We can always analyze, and we can probably do a really good job in finding all the different problems. But what matters is, what is it we're going to do? We have to start supporting folks. It's not just about holding people accountable. Because I told you, we're going to be launching signs, and I'm going to make it available for you so that you can order your own sign and get those names of the people that you want to target in your county offices and or in your state legislature or even in your congressional representative. We want to focus this on your representatives, folks, because they have the legislative power. They are the sovereigns. They have the authority to do this. I mean, we can call out everybody, and I'm okay with you calling out your auditor. I'm okay with you calling out your prosecuting attorney, your sheriff, you know, for being, you know, spineless, for actually doing things that are not constitutional. I'm okay with that. But you need to include your commissioners. They're the ones that are sitting on the power. Your supervisors. When I say commissioners, supervisors, I'll try to do better in just referring to them as county legislators. There's very few states that do that. Very few call them county legislators. So, you know, they're the ones that can, and they're the ones that are your real representatives. They're your first line of defense. When it comes down to defending your position as to where you are, when it comes to tyranny, regardless of where that tyranny is coming from, international, federal, or state, you have a right to go to your county commissioners and say, this is unconstitutional. This is a violation of our rights. And in so doing, because they're under oath, they need to do something. And as long as your expectations fit within their will well, which everything we've put into these petitions fit within their will well, it won't raise their budget any or hardly at all. It may take a little time for them to make an endorsement or what have you, and they may need to give up a little resources to create a committee or an assembly or a council. Doesn't matter. All of these things they cannot justify why they will not create a constitutional compliance committee. So therefore, that's why we start there and we end up running it up and we expand it across the state and so forth. So I would encourage everybody, read a petition, grab a petition, and just go to the final eight expectations. And then ask yourself, well, why can't they do this? Most everything is just demanding other people get involved in doing it too and getting everybody involved. So once you've got your county constitutional compliance committee going, now you can start putting the heat on the party and saying, hey, the county wants to have a constitutional compliance committee, and we need to align with that because, you know, this is where we can actually start separating the wheat from the chaff. Now, welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
No problem. So, let me ask you this. I know separating wheat from the chaff, right? That's kind of a biblical reference. And so I'm hoping people start understanding that we're literally at that point in time worldwide separating the good from the bad. So if we actually start getting the county doing this, and when I say county, I mean both at the grassroots and at the government level, I can't see how this is not going to grow legs and take off. especially when people start understanding the power that, and the power isn't instant. It's not like when you're holding that fire hose, you go from zero to whatever the maximum, you know, water pressure is. Yeah, I mean, you might have a valve that can do that pretty quickly, but like with a gate valve, the gate valve is pretty slow. The water pressure keeps on increasing, increasing until it's open wide, and you get the full brunt of the water pressure. And good luck if you're not holding that that hose well. But the fact is that the power of the people will grow because people will start getting it. Anyway, we've got a candidate, and I want you to get out there and support him. The contact information is on the candidate endorsement page on Reclaiming the Republic. It's Jerry Wistrand. Please give him some support. I know everybody needs gas. I know everybody, because of the inflation, it's just getting crazy. He needs help. If we're going to do this, we have to start helping those who are willing to be held accountable, which means that you need to start considering running your own race. And if you're running your race, let me ask you this. Would you want help? I think so. So we all need to help each other, regardless of where it is. And it doesn't matter. In America, if somebody's standing up on the cause of liberty and full compliance with the Constitution, we all win. Their successes are our successes. So with all the other cliches put aside, we kind of wrapped up still going through the Massachusetts debates. And what we covered last was Mr. Nason's comment regarding the oath of office and how ultimately that oath is basically getting the people in the government through under that oath, under this new oath, to actually start violating their oath and their responsibility to the state. And that's not the case at all. As a matter of fact, when we really look at the case of the oath as it's written and as it's implied, based on the language and based on the definition, when you have legislators that are going into Congress, whether they be a senator, whether they be a representative, they have very limited powers. Their oath is to stay within those powers, period, to not seek powers outside of those enumerated powers, and to hold everybody else accountable. I have no idea how this is an affront against your state and against your sovereignty. It's not. So Mr. Nason was, you know, I'll just say grinding an axe. We're now at this point in time, we're at the very end of the debates in Massachusetts. So those who are standing up as anti-federalists are those who I would consider probably the key ring readers. Every once in a while, I have this dyslexic talent. Anyway, sorry for digressing poorly, really, really bad right there. So Mr. Nason is definitely one of those, and I won't say it wrong this time, key ringleaders in trying to do everything he can to keep this Constitution from getting ratified in the Massachusetts Convention. And so now he's coming up with this comment regarding a standing army. So before we read this, let me ask you this. How many times is a standing army mentioned in the Constitution?
I don't believe it is. Maybe once. I'm not sure where I heard that from.
So technically, the term standing army is not in.
I didn't think so.
In the Constitution. What it does is it gives them the power to create an army. If they're going to create an army, they can only create a budget for no more than 2 years to do so. And to create an army, they must call forth the militia. They do not have the power to just go off and create a charter. Because remember, we already covered this last year. We haven't covered it yet. When we get into the Assumption Act, we will cover it, and I'll highlight it, folks. For the government to create a bank, for the government to create an institution like an army, The only legitimate way that they have the power to do so, because it's enumerated, they have the power to call forth the militia for three things. That's when they can form an army. For them to actually create an army would require that they now have the power to, you know, create an institution via charter, because it's not enumerated in the Constitution for them to actually go out and create a mercenary force and to be able to wage war everywhere in the world. No, they have the responsibility of creating a navy, and they have the responsibility of forming the army out of the militia. So, as we look at this, because the Navy is not to turn its guns at all towards the United States, the Navy's responsibility is to guard us from external threats. It is our strategic force. The Army itself, and this is where they talk about this in more detail regarding the mischiefs of an army on our soil, where they, you know, actually have the guns among us, they talk about the mischief of that and how... And he'll talk about it as well, but a standing army is where they now take on this grander role of being able to enforce federal law without actually having, basically by a mercenary force. The standing army that they refer to when they use the term standing army, that is a mercenary, that is a professional force, that is kind of, it's a permanent force that the king, whoever the emperor is, they create that to guard themselves, and they create that to basically enforce their own laws and so forth. So anyway, that was the whole point. It wasn't a military force to go off and fight a war. A standing army was really, because back in those days, they didn't have the term, they may have had the term constable, but they did, and back in those days, it may have been, you know, like a sheriff and so forth that was kind of a law enforcement, tax collection, that type of thing, code enforcer. But a standing army was somebody that reported to the king, to the chief, the emperor, and they were accountable to him, they were paid by him, and they were loyal to him. And they knew that they could not allow that type of loyal force to be created. Ergo, we, you know, have this little comment, so I'm going to let you go ahead and start ripping with the anti-federalist comment regarding the standing armies and so forth. Go ahead.
The eighth section, Mr. President, provides that Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, etc. We may, sir, be poor. We may not be able to pay these taxes, etc. We must have a little meal and a little meat whereon to live and save a little for a rainy day. But what follows? Let us see. To raise and support armies. Here, sir, comes the key to unlock this cabinet. Here is the mean by which you will be made to pay taxes. But will ye, my countrymen, submit to this? Suffer me, sir, to say a few words on the fatal effects of standing armies, that bane of Republican governments. A standing army, was it not with this that Caesar passed the Rubicon and laid prostrate the liberties of his country? By this have 7/8 of the once free nations of the globe been brought into bondage? Time would fail me were I to attempt to recapitulate the havoc made in the world by standing armies. Britain attempted to enforce her arbitrary measures by a standing army. But, sir, we had patriots then who alarmed us of our danger, who showed us the serpent and bade us beware of it. Shall I name them? I fear I shall offend your excellency, but I cannot avoid it. I must. We had a Hancock, an Adams, and a Warren. Our sister states, too, produced a Randolph, a Washington, a Greene, and a Montgomery, who led us in our way. Some of these have given up their lives in defense of the liberties of their country. And my prayer to God is that when this race of illustrious patriots shall bid adieu to the world, from their dust, as from the sacred ashes of the phoenix, another race may arise, who shall take our posterity by the hand and lead them on to trample on the necks of those who shall dare to infringe on their liberties. Sir, had I a voice like Jove, I would proclaim it throughout the world. And had I an arm like Jove, I would hurl from the globe those villains that would dare attempt to establish in our country a standing army. I wish, sir, that the gentlemen of Boston would bring to their mind the fatal evening of the 5th of March, 1770, when by standing troops they lost five of their fellow townsmen. I will ask them, what price can atone for their lives? What money can make satisfaction for the loss? The same causes produce the same effects. An army may be raised on pretense of helping a friend, or many pretenses might be used. That night, sir, ought to be a sufficient warning against standing armies, except in cases of great emergency. They are too frequently used for no other purpose than dragooning the people into slavery. But I beseech you, my countrymen, for the sake of your posterity, to act like those worthy men who have stood forth in defense of the rights of mankind, and show to the world that one should come upon us, we have a militia, which is our bulwark. Let Lexington witness that we have the means of defense among ourselves. If during the last winter there is not much alacrity shown by the militia in turning out, we must consider that they were going to fight their countrymen. Do you, sir, suppose that had a British army invaded us at that time, such supineness would have been discovered? No, sir. To our enemies' dismay and discomfort, they would have felt the contrary, but against deluded, infatuated men, they did not wish to exert their valor or their strength. Therefore, sir, I am utterly opposed to a standing army in time of peace. The paragraph that gives Congress the power to suspend the writ of habeas corpus claims a little attention. This is a great bulwark, a great privilege indeed. We ought not, therefore, to give it up on any slight pretense. Let us see how long it is to be suspended. As long as rebellion or invasion shall continue, this is exceeding loose. Why is not the time limited, as is our Constitution? But, sir, its design would then be defeated. It was the intent, and by it we shall give up one of our greatest privileges. Mr. N. concluded by saying he had much more to say, but as the House were impatient, he should sit down for the present to give other gentlemen an opportunity to speak.
Okay, and thank heavens that there was the need for other gentlemen to speak, because he was being very selective. As a matter of fact, I'll use the John Birch Society term that they use on me, which I think they're far more guilty of. He was being intentionally deceptive. Because when we go to the first time he kind of mentioned, at the very beginning here, he says, to raise and support a standing army, and not finish that clause. Now, when you read the clause itself, you can actually see that that's a comma, not a semicolon. When you actually read Article 1, Section 8, says to raise and support standing armies, but, so that's not a break of a second, you know, thing that needs to be done as a second item, but it is a constraint upon that clause just stated. But no appropriation of money to that use shall be for longer than a term than 2 years. The whole point of this clause isn't letting them create a mercenary army force. It is when they have to call forth the militia and federalize the army, they can only do it for a limited time of 2 years, no more, so that they can't run away with taxes and they can't run away with this long-term control, okay? So I kind of led into this with that comment, right? Didn't I cover that already?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then he talks a little bit further, and he says, Britain attempt to enforce her arbitrary measures by a standing army. But, sir, we had patriots then who alarmed us of our danger, who showed us the serpent and bade us beware of it. What he's talking about is, yes, Britain actually had standing armies, and all sorts of mischief came from it. And when the people became ignorant of their rights, then they got away with it. But when people became informed, because the Magna Carta required a standing militia. Did you know that?
Nope.
The Magna Carta required that if you had a certain amount of property, you were required to have a sword. If you had a certain amount of property and other resources, you were required to have a sword, a shield, and maybe an arrows. You know, so the more you possessed, the more you were capable, you were to be armed with a certain amount of armament and defenses and so forth. To where I think, you know, they had slings and cannons, and I don't know if they had necessarily cannons or mortars or what have you, but if you go through the Magna Carta, you'll actually see how it lays out these hard requirements for all of the Englishmen to be armed. And so one would think, and actually I believe that the intent out the gate and the reason it was probably, it lingered for a while. Do you know when the bloody period of England occurred? It was during the Tudor period, right? They called her Bloody Mary. She was a tyrant. And so that was a ways down from King John. And people tend to forget. They, you know, well, why does Grandpa have a sword? Why did Great Grandpa have a sword? You know, everybody holds that sword. It's you know, I'm just giving you metaphorical kind of placement. You know, they mounted above the fireplace as a remembrance of, you know, what happened a long, long time ago. And, wow, you know, we have a sword. Everybody else either got rid of theirs, they sold them, they threw them away because they got rusted, what have you. But bottom line, if you're not using them and if, you know, everything's going good, then you don't need to use them. And so we forget why we have them. And we don't teach people of the importance of maintaining these things. Our forefathers did the same thing. When our government came to them and established a Social Security program, where were the lessons of allowing government to actually start giving us things that they had no power, or the danger from the titler cycle of democracy, or just those few words from Benjamin Franklin, when government can give you everything, then government can take everything from you. Those types of warnings. How come that didn't happen when all of a sudden Social Security was being proffered to the American people? Well, I'll tell you why. Because people were desperate, and people had forgotten some of their history, and most of them were not connecting the dots, or they at least thought, as another Franklin quote, you know, the more security government can offer, the less security you're going to have. Something like that. I'm paraphrasing, and I know you could probably come up with it, because it rings loud of what they were looking to invoke, this social security, a financial security. Oh, they're going to give you financial security? Then that means that they're going to take control over your finances. And if you look, folks, we have a mercantile system. They have full control over our finances. Anybody that's got a 401k, a retirement, or anything that's considered a protected retirement nest egg that's not social security, they still have control over it. And they can seize it and keep it from you. So, as we start looking at, you know, the lessons, yeah, I mean, we're suffering from the exact same thing because we have forgotten. But what he's saying here is it's inaccurate because, yeah, we still have the responsibility of militias today. But it has nothing to do with the need for the militia. It's the need for holding government accountable, because our government, unlike the king, was limited in its powers, and we needed to understand the lessons of the ratification debates. Now he goes on a little bit and starts talking about because he talks quite a bit about the army, and the biggest focus of this is that. But the final paragraph he talks about goes along with that exact same thing. Once a standing army is created, then he says, hey, what about this thing in Article 1, Section 9, that they can actually suspend habeas corpus? They can basically, that right there is what we call martial law. And so because it's martial law and because what he's throwing out here, let me get into this when we come back. Because he's getting away with saying some things that I don't believe that there's really probably a really good response that I don't recall, so because I don't see anything that's highlighted after this. But I know in Virginia, they really clarified this. So we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so here's kind of an interesting point that, you know, when you really read after, because I took a quick glance through this, Judge Sumner kind of is the only one that really makes something right after Nason. Everybody else, for the most part, is more focused on the amendments. And I think one of the reasons why Nason was probably really using a little hyperbole or hyperbole, however you want to say it. And as this final comment that he throws out, he says, the paragraph that gives Congress power to suspend the writ of habeas corpus claims a little attention. This is a great bulwark, a privilege indeed. We ought not, therefore, to give it up on a slight pretense. Let us see how long it is to be suspended. As long as a rebellion or invasion shall continue, this is exceedingly loose. So obviously, and I want to point this out, it was obviously brought up somehow in some discussion and by common knowledge that when the militia is deployed during an invasion or during an insurrection, then there is an application of what they call martial law. Only when the militia is deployed, though. And so he says, and that's what he basically says, as long as the rebellion and invasion shall continue, he says, this is exceedingly loose, because that means that they can, we're still suppressing the insurrection or what have you. Actually, when you get into Virginia, they even narrow it down. So I want to hope everybody understands that this, he's admitting, is the anti-federalist. That the ability to suspend habeas corpus is tied to the deployment of the militia for suppressing insurrections and repelling invasions. And it is further clarified, we'll get to it, and I'll prove so, and I won't get up and do an end zone dance because, you know, they'll probably throw my back out or something. But anyway, I will prove that they talk about the clarity of this, because martial law is not a nationwide sweeping declaration as it was in England. It is clarified in the Virginia ratification debates that martial law is only applied where necessary. In other words, wherever the insurrection is. So during 2020, where the insurrections were in Kentucky, were in Seattle, and these cities, martial law would have only been applied there. Not nationwide. It would never have been applied to Wyoming. It would never have been applied to, you know, all these other states and the majority of these states that where there were these insurrections. So the point is that martial law is declared and applied during the insurrection and the suppressing of and or an invasion, and only where it is occurring. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I had a thought. What would you call what happened during COVID when the government said everybody stay in their house for 2 weeks and that, people were being arrested for being on the beach by themselves?
Well, so it's that's easy. That was unconstitutional. When Trump was told by his advisors to do a 2-week pause. Now, technically, if you look at what he did on the federal side, it was very light.
Right.
The tyranny actually came.
He took full advantage.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to say anything. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just saying he left it up to the governors. Yeah.
There you go. So the governors were the ones that were the tyrants. And it was the blue states where it really, even in Wyoming, Governor Gordon thought he could get away with becoming a little tyrant because everybody else was doing it. And the Wyomings, or the Wyomingites, they, you know, said, hey, you can't do this. And it was tried and proven that he wasn't going to get away with it because there was just not enough, there was no ability for him to enforce it. Now, in the blue states, they actually did go around and enforce. The blue states have become very tyrannical. I mean, folks, that right there, when they start suspending your rights and suspending, habeas corpus is a specific right, but when they say you've got to shut down your churches, when they say you can't go to work and make money, and they suspend your right of survival, how is that not the greatest threat upon you as a citizen? That is your ability to survive. It is not government's job to take care of you. And that's what they've been doing. And that's why they call it a safety net. Folks, if we don't shed this crap, then it's over. We have the ability to shed this. We have the ability to take care of ourselves. We kind of talked about this, how to do this. This has to go back to the states. This is where the power should reside, and technically not at the state level, but at the county level. Because if we keep it at the county level, then we'll actually have more, I'll just say, more of a righteous application of compassionate services and compassionate help. When people really need help, they're going to get help, and there's not going to be a lot of gold going into people's pockets. The grander the scale of it, the grander the corruption, the grander the stealing of the wealth of America. Back to this, I want you to understand, he's admitting there are constraints upon martial law. It doesn't say that here, but do you see how, when you really analyze what he's talking about, he's applying how during these cases, they can actually suspend our rights. That means martial law. I wish they would have actually said this, because when you start scrubbing through the ratification debates and you look for martial law, if it's not mentioned, then, okay, you didn't think they talked about it. But here's a backhanded way where they were talking about it. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. So, anyway, when you go to what the next gentleman, Judge Sumner, says, and I'll go ahead and read this. Adverting to the pathetic apostrophe of the gentleman last speaking, said he could with as much sincerity apostrophize, O government, thou greatest good, thou best of blessings, with thee I wish to live, with thee I wish to die. Thou art necessary to support the political body as meat and bread are to the natural body. The learned judge then, so they basically showed that he made a mockery of him. And then he basically says, now this very wise judge turned his attention to the proposition submitted, because now everybody just completely forgot what he was talking about and started focusing on the amendments. Because if you go through the rest of the comments from Mr. Widgery and Dana, Judge Dana, Mr. Russell's, and so forth, they're all really focused on what kind of amendments they want to have and so forth. And so it was wise of the judge, because I didn't see anybody else talking about habeas corpus or what have you, because it just doesn't jump out. So you really have to read these things from the beginning to the end to really get everything. Now, folks, I will say this. The wise person will take a clean, because if you have my ratification debates, you see a lot of little added notes. And when I say added notes, not adding, changing the content of what they're saying, but hey, here's the militia mentioned, here's this militia, and highlights and that type of stuff, and the inserted comments. When you go through mine, you've got that noise. Take the ratification debates and get rid of all of the highlights. Then you go to the very end of the ratification debates, you print out the list of names of all the anti-federalists. And then you do a search in the document for every time that person speaks. then you highlight what that person speaks with red or a yellow. That way you know that when you're reading something yellow, this person is likely either using hyperbole, lying, or saying things that are inaccurate so that they would get you to vote against the ratification. The people that supported or did not support the Constitution, that wanted to actually shut the Constitution down, those anti-federalists, their comments were rejected. In other words, when you really distill this down, when the convention decided whether to ratify or not, did they believe the Federalists or did they believe the anti-federalists? Because who they believed, the other they rejected. So you highlight those comments that were rejected. Now you have, because I just placed context to this, those are rejected comments. They have no relevance. Now you can go through with a green or something else and then highlight the Federalists, and then you can use different colors like yellow or blue or red in the green to denote certain types of things. Had I done this, really thought about this, because I was reading the ratification base for years before I really came to this conclusion of separating the comments of the anti-federalists to the federalists. And if you do it, that it's a body of work, but I've already put a lot of work to this. And so I'm just helping you understand why I do highlight some of the anti-federalists, because we have to prove that what they're saying is hyperbole and intentionally deceptive, because they're not giving you the full thing. Oh, they have the power to raise armies, but they didn't tell you about the constraints that are attached to that power. Why did he not add that? Because he was being intentionally deceptive. It's like when somebody tells you and quotes a scripture to you, and they don't tell you the rest of the scripture. I can tell you during the Martin Luther days, people started getting wise to that those types of ploys. We need to be just as equally wise today. We need to start realizing how manipulative people can be with information and data. It's kind of like I hear those who are supporting nullification, the way it's being applied today. You'll see the 10th Amendment Center, and you'll see the John Birch Society and other organizations. See, I didn't mention John Birch first. It's the 10th Amendment Center. They'll come out and they'll quote Madison in stating that Thomas Jefferson would be an advocate for nullification. It's our greatest defense, something like that. It's out of Madison's notes on nullification. The following line is where Jefferson himself would stand up and be appalled at the concept of single state nullification and remaining in the Union. So when you read this one verse, and we'll get to it when we get there, and I'll highlight it for you folks, and I'll say, why is it that they only read this part of this one paragraph? This is a short paragraph. They only read this one part, and they don't tell you the rest of it. Huh. Because it's intentionally deceptive. Don't take my word for these things, folks. You need to read these. Because, yeah, you may be smart because I'm an honest person, but you have to be smart because you intend to. You're doing the due diligence. This has to be on you. It's like, you got good kids that get raised because they had great parents. Well, that doesn't mean that they're going to be great parents. They have to become great parents. They have to apply themselves. They have to learn their own lessons. I hope this is making sense. This is why I constantly say, don't take my word for it. This is one of the reasons why, I really stand bold and say, prove me wrong. I even have, and I want to post it, but I need to really put some clarity and some context to it. I would love to post, I bet my life, because that's how bold I am on this, folks. I bet my life that many of these people, like Glenn Beck and the rest of these guys, they cannot, it's kind of like the rich man coming to Christ and saying, what do I need to do to go to heaven? I'm living the Ten Commandments. And Christ says, you got to get rid of everything. Because he knew. He knew where his heart was. And so I am betting my life that these men will probably not be able to do that. They're not going to be able to, kill the goose that's laying their golden egg and stand up and support this cause of killing their goose. because they love the golden eggs that come from that goose. They just can't do it. Now, I would love to see them prove me wrong. I'd love to see Glenn Beck get proving me wrong. I'd love to see Sean Hannity prove me wrong, and then I'd leave it to them. If they're truly good men and they are on the cause of liberty, I leave it to them to decide, because I'm betting my life here, whether they really want me to spill my life. And I'll leave it to them. Because if they really are good men, but I will probably venture to say that there would be more of a likelihood of a conspiracy that a few of these men would do it, and then they'd go back to their evil ways. Does that make sense? Because when you get so compromised, sometimes evil can really do some pretty dark things. But my point is, folks, I'm bold enough to say these things. I'm willing to put my life on the line. These guys, yeah. What are they putting on the line? A few hundred here, what have you. Almost everything they do it to make money. Any comments before we move forward?
No, I think that was a good analogy with the rich man from the scriptures, because that's exactly what the situation is.
Right. Okay, great. You know, it's when you can frame metaphors. One of the things I want you to notice, folks, with the Massachusetts debates, they don't cover a lot of stuff, but they do cover key things that actually helps galvanize how important these things are. Because when you're looking at February 2nd, you know, there's only three comments made. And when I go from February 2nd to February 4th, we're only talking about one page. One page, they debated for one page worth of words. No, they were probably in subcommittees or side conversations and so forth, and there wasn't much to be stated for the body of the whole. But when key orations were made, that's when they wrote those things down. They captured that. And the next key one is by Mr. Thatcher, or actually, let's be clear, Reverend Thatcher. And Reverend Thatcher has this note, and it kind of goes for a long ways because he really speaks how important and how sacred he sees this Constitution, but don't take my word for it. Let's read this. And, you know, Sean, it is a long piece, so feel free to pause, and I will interrupt when we get close to the end of the show. So go ahead.
All righty, sir. With respect to the first of these considerations, I trust there is no man in his senses but what will own that the whole country hath largely felt the want of energy in the general government. While we were at war with Britain, common danger produced a common union, but the cause being removed, the effect ceased also. Nay, I do not know, but we may safely add that union produced by uniform danger was still inadequate to general and national purposes. This commonwealth, with a generous, disinterested regard to the good of the whole, appeared foremost in a day of danger. At the conclusion of the late war, two-thirds of the Continental Army were from Massachusetts. Their provision and their clothing proceeded also in a great measure from our extraordinary exertions. The people did this in the fullest confidence that when peace and tranquility were restored, from the honor and justice of our sister states, our supernumerary expenses would be abundantly repaid. But alas, how much hath our expectation been blasted? The Congress, though willing, yet had no power to do us justice. The small district of Rhode Island put a negative upon the collected wisdom of the continent. This was done not by those who are patrons of their present infamous system of paper currency, but by that part of them who now call themselves honest men.
Can you stop right there, if I could interrupt you? Mm-hmm. When you really look at what he's saying here, he's basically laying out a lot of little details that if you don't understand the nuances based on the language itself, we really kind of miss this, because he's talking about the want of energy, because everybody wanted this government to be able to effectively pay people back and collect money and so forth. But once the war was over, who cares about that? Well, and now he's pointing out that we, Massachusetts, and you've heard me say this, Massachusetts was humbled. They were attacked first because they were the haughty state. They still have a haughty problem. Now, they did rise to the occasion, and he points out 2/3 of the Continental Army was from Massachusetts, which means that they were due this pay. They were due these benefits. As a matter of fact, the bulk of the things that they were promised was land. Many of the men that went and served and risked their lives were promised that they would get a plot of land in the new territory up in the Northwest Ordinance. And that was actually actualized in the Northwest Ordinance. But it didn't get transferred into the Constitution. But when we go through the Constitutional Convention, not the Convention, the Congressional Record, you'll see, and I can give it to you folks, but we may not have time to do it, but we can literally see how they recognize the importance of paying these patriots back and getting them that land and how to do that. And they were troubled in ways of doing that because they had this new government and they didn't have their pockets full of gold. But nevertheless, he's going through and we're seeing a great snapshot of history, of the sentiments during trouble and how the abandonment of those sentiments quickly come. It's almost like, have you ever seen in a movie or have you ever known or have you ever done, you know, this where you get on your knees and you plead to God, please save me, I'll do everything, you know, I'll do this. And as soon as you're saved, you get up and you don't do a thing. And that is just so common that it was manifested in our history here. And I think that looking at this in a macro view, you can kind of see this and how everybody was turning their back. And again, Rhode Island gets pointed out because they were the leaders in the shenanigans. Go ahead from that. Thank you.
We have made exertion to stop the importation of foreign luxuries. Our brethren in the neighboring states, from the view of local advantages, have taken occasion to distress us upon the same account. They have encouraged where we have prohibited, and by those iniquitous measures have made our virtue and public spirit an additional cause of our calamity. Nor have our calamities been local. They have reached to all parts of the United States and have produced dissipation and indigence at home and contempt in foreign countries. On the one hand, the haughty Spaniard has deprived us of the navigation of the River Mississippi. On the other hand, the British nation are, by extravagant duties, ruining our fishery. Our sailors are enslaved by the pirates of our Algiers. Our credit is reduced to so low an ebb that American faith is a proverbial expression for perfidy, as Punic faith was among the Romans. Thus have we suffered every species of infamy abroad and poverty at home. Such, in fact, have been our calamities, as are enough to convince the most skeptical among us of the want of a general government, in which energy and vigor should be established, and at the same time, the rights and liberties of the people preserved. A constitution hath been presented to us, which was composed and planned by men who, in the council and field, have, in the most conspicuous offices, served their country in the late war. It comes authenticated by a man who, without any pecuniary award, commanded our army, and who retired to a private station with more pleasure than he left it. I do not say, Mr. President, that this proves the form of government to be perfect, or that it is an unanswerable argument that we should adopt it, but it is a reason why we should examine it with care and caution, and that we ought not rashly and precipitately to reject it. It will be objected, quote, there are more powers granted than are necessary, and that it tends to destroy the local governments of the particular states, and that it will eventually end either in aristocracy or despotism, end quote. To answer the objection, two considerations should be taken into view. The situation of the continent when a constitution was formed, and the impossibility of preserving a perfect sovereignty in the states after necessary powers were ceded to a supreme council of the whole. As to the first, let us candidly examine the state of these republics from New Hampshire to Georgia and see how far vigor and energy were required. During the session of the late convention, Massachusetts was on the point of civil war. In Vermont and New Hampshire, a great disaffection to their several governments prevailed among the people. New York absolutely refused complying with the requisitions of Congress. In Virginia, armed men endeavored to stop the courts of justice. In South Carolina, creditors by law were obliged to receive barren and useless land for contracts made in silver and gold. I pass over the instance of Rhode Island. Their conduct was notorious. In some states, laws were made directly against the Treaty of Peace. In others, statutes were enacted which clashed directly against any federal union. New land sufficient to discharge a great part of the continental debt intruded upon by needy adventurers. Our frontier settlements exposed to the ravages of the Indians, while the several states were unable or unwilling to relieve their distress. Lay all of those circumstances together, and you will find some apology for those gentlemen who framed this Constitution. I trust you may charitably assign other motives for their conduct than a design to enslave their country and to parcel out for themselves its honors and emoluments.
Okay, so right there, I know that you've got a short paragraph and then some more, but I think actually there is time to read that, the next three paragraphs, because they're short, okay. And we'll stop there. Okay, go ahead.
The second consideration deserves its weight. Can these local governments be sufficient to protect us from foreign enemies or from disaffection at home? 13 states are formed already. The same number are probably to be formed from the lands not yet cultivated. Of the former, yet smaller divisions may be made. The province of Maine had desired a separation. In time, a separation may take place. Who knows but what the same may happen with respect to the old colony of Plymouth. Now, conceive the number of states increased their boundaries, lessened their interests clashing. How easy a prey to a foreign power, how liable to war among themselves. Let these arguments be weighed, and I dare say, sir, there is no man but what would conceive that a coercive power over the whole, searching through all parts of the system, is necessary to the preservation and happiness of the whole people.
Now, nobody likes the term coercive. I mean, that just sounds bad. But you have to have the ability to, when somebody promises you something, you have to have the ability, other than their honor, integrity, to get them to pay. Especially when the services have been rendered and the obligation has been met, then it's time to pay. And I think there's a flip way of addressing this, starting calling out those who are refusing to pay, those who are basically dishonest, those who are, you know, literally undermining the good of the whole and so forth. There's other ways of doing it, but bottom line, the term is you have to give coercive powers. You have to give enforcement powers to ensure that justice can be served and debts will be paid. But what we'll do, because we're out of time, I'll let Sean do a go back when we come back. In our next episode, and we'll kind of go over what he covered, and then we'll jump further into, you know, this oration by this good reverend. And folks, I think you're going to start seeing how in Massachusetts, when they're concluding, they have a spiritual view. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.